Welcome back to Crime Capsule. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. This week, we are continuing our conversation with Peggy Jackson Walls, author of Lost Towns of Central Alabama, published by the History Press. If you missed the first part of our interview, be sure to look it up wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks as always for listening. Let's dive back in. Peggy, welcome back to Crime Capsule. Thank you again for joining us.
And again, thank you for inviting me. I've been enjoying it.
There are many types of lost towns in your book. Some of them, these cities were built around gold. Some of them were built around mineral springs. Some of them were built around textiles, but they were all abandoned or let go or destroyed for different reasons. I guess one thing that was kind of interesting to me, Peggy, just generally, was there is a really deep and rich trade history in central Alabama. So many of these towns were built around either manufacture or you know, mining or, you know, things that really involved the stuff of life, you know? And the trades seem to have occupied a major role in area economies for decades and decades and decades.
A lot of that has to do with mining and people's desire to progress and have better lives and to leave a heritage there for their family. And they really, trading was really diverse. And most people, or a lot of people, really don't know that there was a marble quarry near Sylacauga. And like so many of these businesses, Mill Village, etc., the company would build a village. They'd build homes, they'd build stores and churches, they'd be doctors, all sorts of things to have an ordinary life in a village. But the Gant village that you were referring to was rather unique in that these people were working mining marble. And although the marble is actually one of the best in the world, not just in Alabama, but in the world, the work was as stable as in, say, the mill villages. But the Sylacauga marble is the world's widest deposit. It's 32 miles long, 1.5 miles wide, with a depth of more than 600 feet. Ruth Cook is the author of Sylacauga Marble Story. And she says that it's enough that it would serve to as a mine and supply the needs for marble for at least another 200 years.
That is remarkable. That is really something else. Now, I want to ask you just for point of clarification real quick. Sylacauga is still very much functioning, but the lost village or the lost city that is associated with that you mentioned is called Gant Village. And now, who exactly was Gant? Who is the fellow after whom this is named?
Well, he was a businessman for one thing, and he was very knowledgeable about the marble and very involved with it in an artistic way. He brought a lot of interest in the marble, interest in the marble industry at that time, which has lasted. I mean, people are fascinated with that story. And actually, I have a marble heart necklace on right now. From Sylacauga, from the Comer Memorial Library. There were really some notable things that came out of the mining there is the maybe familiar with that large sculpture of Abe Lincoln, who's sitting, looks like he's sitting there in a huge chair.
Of course, in Washington, D.C. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
That's Alabama Gold. But when back when it first started production, mainly the thing that was produced out of it was headstones, as you might think. Years back that people did not have as great a need, but the Greek architecture became revived later on, and there was a lot of need for that, for building these beautiful structures. It's a fascinating story, and Ruth Cook did a lot of research and is from that area. It's the only book I have come across that really told the story of the people there in Gaunt Village. And they, of course, that store that they had, it was, they paid by scrip, and the money had to be cashed in there for groceries and whatever else their needs might be. The little post office there was also a store and library. And it's very small, and it is behind the library in Sylacauga. And I have been in there a couple of times, but it's really amazing the how small it is. That I guess they didn't have as many people as they would have now, and maybe even not as much need. I'm not sure about that.
Well, it's a fascinating account of a resource, of a, you know, an aspect of Alabama's history, which I think a lot of folks don't realize, you know, that the contribution that marble, you know, has made to the rest of this country and so forth. Now, there is another dimension to this, which I just have to ask you about. You do include it in your book, and as I read it, I thought, you know, this is almost too good to be true. And then it wasn't. It was not too good to be true. It was, in fact, true, which is the story of Ann Hodges. This has nothing to do with the Lost City. I just have to ask you about it because it's amazing. The story of Ann Hodges in this area, who was the first woman to ever be hit by a meteorite. So, what on earth? Just what off of earth? I mean.
Just trying to take a restful nap on her sofa. And this meteorite falls through. And I don't know, it may be person. I would have to look that up again. Not just woman, it may be person. But anyway, it really, she got so much attention that she eventually had a nervous breakdown over that. And they were renting, she and her husband were renting a house, and the person from whom they were renting wanted to claim the meteorite. She said it was her house, her property, so she should have it. But it eventually the meteorite went to Anne. She said, God hit me with it, so it's mine.
Maybe he was trying to tell her something, but you know, who knows what it was.
But anyway, she was paid a little bit of money, and it is like everything else of interest in a museum or an archive. It went first to the Air Force, and like I say, to several other places, but that's where it's located now.
There you go. Well, before we turn our attention to the last lost city that we're going to talk about today, I do just have to signal, I'm not going to spoil a dang thing here, Peggy. I just want our listeners to know that if they have ever wondered where the song Stars Fell on Alabama, or Stars Fell Over Alabama, where that came from, we're not going to tell them. We're not going to spoil them right here. I'm just going to say that if they ever wanted to know where, what the origin of Stars Fell Over Alabama, you know, is where that song came from. You have one of the best explanations for it in your book that I have ever encountered, with the most detail. And we're just going to leave it at that. Maybe they want to go listen to the song first before they go and pick up a copy of your book. I don't know. We'll leave that just kind of hanging there for a hot second. But in the context of, you know, folks getting hit by meteors, it was just such a lovely, lovely little inclusion there. And I just wanted to say thank you for that. And now let us turn our attention to the drowned towns of central Alabama. And this is a topic that hits very, very near and dear to my heart, because when I was just a young whippersnapper living overseas for the first time, I spent a good deal of time in the United Kingdom. As a younger man, I first encountered the concept, the idea, the existence of these drowned towns with the city, the town of Derwent in central England. There is a reservoir called the Lady Bower Dam that was built for this reservoir, and it was there were two little villages, that were flooded. And of course, some of the things that you describe in your book, Peggy, arose in that same context, where you have village, dam is built, village is flooded, and yet they leave some of the buildings intact. You can still hear the ghostly church bells ringing in the church towers, when the water moved just right. Or more to sort of to the point, and this has happened very, very recently, when the water level drops, you can go and see the spire of the church tower still sticking out of the water, and it's very moody and ghostly and ethereal and atmospheric, all these sorts of things. You have a number of these in your book, right? That was my first introduction, was a case from the 1950s back over in the UK. But you write about a ton of these. They're kind of all scattered throughout this region. How did you first get on to the idea of the drowned town?
Well, again, when I talk with people, they may not know the entire story, but they will give me names until I get a really good story. The Martin Dam is really a good example of when the dam is built, they have to have men to come in and work for years doing all the work to make that possible. And as in other things, industries, there were villages built. This one was built Cherokee Bluff. And this is where the people grew up, the children grew up. That's if they remember, growing up there, which some do, they remember some really important things, during World War II, where one thing they had was a hospital, and they would bring the soldiers that were wounded over, to that hospital there at Cherokee Bluff. And they had the usual about stores and post office and et cetera, but they had unusual way of distributing mail. They would just put it in this big mailbox, and people would stop by, and they'd shift through the envelopes and so forth and find their mail and claim it. Those little villages were pretty well developed and very interesting. And I don't think you could tell any difference about growing up in a village like that than growing up, say, Alexander City, because it was just independent. They had everything they needed. They had doctors and, like I said, a hospital and post office and just many other things that just an ordinary town would have.
Now, one of the ones you write about in detail is a town called Benson. And Benson is, that's a fascinating place, partly because, you know, last week we were talking about the deprivations of the slave economy in the antebellum period and so forth. And Benson is almost the exact reverse of that with its sort of origin story. So tell us about the town of Benson and who John Benson was and his family. It really reverses a lot of that damage that was done, you know, previously. Fascinating place.
Oh, I love talking about Benson. It's a unique story and very few people know it. And it's a significant story. And I had, when some people knew I was writing about it, this is an odd thing. When you write, you get sometimes these calls. I'm interested in your sources. Where do you get your information? I did get it through unusual sources, but they were valid sources. And John Benson was a slave. He was freed with other slaves at the end of the Civil War. And he went to Cahaba coal mine and worked there for like $10 a month. And his dream was to go back and buy the farm where he grew up and worked. And the man who owned it, his name was Benson. It was Benson Plantation, and John's name was Benson, and the town was named Benson. And one of the goals was that he wanted to buy that land, and over a period of time, he did manage to buy a lot of it. And he had a son named William, who he wanted so much for him to get the education that he was not able to get, and other at that time black students or even adults, of course. And this was an all black town, and the residents built it. I mean, they built it, and it's beautiful. And some of the buildings you would think were from some city or something. One was a hall, a large hall that had the industrial school there. They taught the skills that you would need to be successful in life. They had ordinary sort of things that you would deal with in life, just like I say, skills of the boys would learn how to use tools and build things and so forth, and the girls worked, in a type of lunch and building, and to sew, and there were some who were made teachers, and just really an exciting thing, considering any time, anywhere, but coming out of the Civil War to achieve that was just so impressive. Now, the buildings were very close to Kowalaja, and you have a lot of knowledge, I'm sure, about where Kowalaja is, some of the significance of it. They had a turpentine mill, and there were a large number of the people worked there, and they sold the turpentine, sent it over to Germany and other foreign countries, and really had a lot of money to sustain what they were trying to do. But unfortunately, World War I came along, and it just closed that market, it shut down a lot of the economic income. But there were some northern philanthropists who helped. Thank you.
I mean, this is a powerful story of achievement in the Black community. You describe how Benson himself, once he became owner of some of that land and had purchased it back, he was sponsoring other families to live on it, offering them, you know, very affordable, you know, rates and terms and so forth. You know, he became a benefactor for education and commerce throughout the entire area. Now, you write that Cowalaja eventually merged with the Alexander City school system in the 1960s, that sort of after that World War I era shift in its landscape, you know, the educational landscape changed as well. In your the context of the sort of the idea of the drowned town, the lost city, and where these once very prominent settlements had stood, what shape is Benson in now?
Well, Benson went through a period there of part of the land, which was significant, a huge amount of acreage. Part of that was became one of the drowned towns. There was a portion left that there was a small school on, but eventually that too disappeared. The William, the son, who was more or less in charge of the school, died suddenly, mysteriously. But he had gone north to, I believe, Washington for the Howard College, and he had every qualification that he could have gone to city to get a prominent position. There was a lot of unrest in Tallapoosa County because the greatest sharecropping union was in Tallapoosa County, and that is another story.
Sure. What do we know about William's death? Why do you say that there were mysterious circumstances surrounding that?
There was never anything that was discovered or revealed or said about that. It just he died young. He outlived his father. And I will say, going back to Benson, one of the buildings that survived was really a very, very nice building that had all of these rooms that they taught these different skills, et cetera. And they would have guests come from the east and north, different places to see how they conducted all of their business there. But anyway, at one point, after some of that land was sold, which a great deal of it was sold into the Russell family, and a lot of that land around there was purchased, and you find quite a lot. There was Russell lands, farms. There's a lot of those areas where they have these large resort homes. But to get back to what I was saying about what survived in that building, it was made into a country club. And people from Alexander City would go to the country club, and they had bands and, you know, large banquets, et cetera.
You know, this is this whole history is one that kind of exists in a little bit of a paradox. Doesn't it, Peggy? You know, we write about these cities, we read about these cities as though they were lost. But thanks to the work that you and other historians have done, they're not totally lost. You know, they're still with us in some ways, and we still have access to some of their stories, which gives us a glimpse into what it was like to live and to work and to sort of try to prosper in a place like Cahaba or Gantt Village or Benson. You know, it's really enigmatic. It's very evocative. And, you know, for those of us who might be traveling through the region. You know, I just love to think of your book not just as a collection of histories, plural, but it's also a guidebook. You know, it's also a map, right? And you know, we can use that to go and visit some of these places and really dip our toe into the waters of the past in a very real and powerful way. So thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me too. Thank you for inviting me.
So Peggy, one of the things that we love to ask our authors when they come and visit us is, what are you working on now? Have you found some more lost cities that you're currently investigating, or are you on to something completely new?
Well, I'm actually working on two books, and one is a mill town, Bevel in Alexander City, which is from Avondale Mills. But the other one is more personal, and I'm trying to give it priority. It is the story of my stepfather, who was in World War II. He was in George Patton's unit, and he was in, I think it was three or four major amphibious landings. He was at the battle at Anzio, which is, you never heard of it. It's, there have been books written about it. One was The Death Trap, I'll give you an idea. But he was taken prisoner after liberation in Rome, and he was in three different prison camps. And that's where he was whenever there was the liberation. And it's a story that should be told.
That's fascinating. Well, all the best to you as you research that one. That sounds wonderful. For folks who would love to learn more about your work or pick up a copy of one of your books, what's the best way to do that?
Well, I have a website. I don't sell copies from that. It's just more or less an advertisement and sharing of information. It's alabamagoalyes.com.
Mm-hmm. And if folks wanted to go and purchase one, what's the best place for them to do that?
Well, probably my publisher, Arcadia History Press. I think I probably should say that.
I have a feeling they'd appreciate it. Well, thank you so much. This really has been such a pleasure. You know, I feel like I have learned so much about a region which is, it is personally close to home, and yet there are still so many things that are waiting to be discovered there, and your book is just such a huge step forward, you know, in that particular process. So I really do appreciate it.
Well, I've enjoyed this very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening. Our guest has been Peggy Jackson Walls, author of Lost Towns of Central Alabama, published by the History Press. To order a copy of the book, visit your local independent bookstore or visit arcadiapublishing.com. Join us next week as we speak to Mark Lardis, author of a book on the lost cities and shipwrecks along the Texas coastline. See you then. Thanks as always to our producer, Bill Huffman, our production director, Bridget Coyne, audio engineer, Ian Douglas, and our executive producers, Michael DeLoya and Gerardo Orlando. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. Crime Capsule is a production of Evergreen Podcasts and a signature title of the Killer Podcasts Network. You can find Crime Capsule wherever you listen to podcasts. Discover more great true crime and paranormal programming at killerpodcasts.com.
"3 AM, the comedy horror podcast that holds weekly gatherings around the campfire. Let me tell you what you're going to get. You're going to hear stories about demonic possessions, prison stabbings, skinwalkers, glitches in the Matrix, cult leaders, missing 411, night marchers, Operation Paperclip, Mesopotamian devil worship, and so many monsters it'll give Kanye West a runaway for his money. Pop and meme culture also aren't off topic. A camp where laughs and scares are constantly competing for first place. We're just a group of friends trying to bust each other's balls, find the best stories, and expand the circle in the process. 3 a.m., the comedy horror podcast, not for the faint or fragile of heart. Let's go."